Dr. Julie Melanick began her medical training intending to become a surgeon. But after she experienced the grueling hours of a surgical residency, she opted instead to study pathology and wound up working as a New York City forensic pathologist. She's called her book, which she wrote with her husband T.J. Mitchell, Working Stiff, 2 years, 262 bodies, and the making of a medical examiner. It is published by Scribner, and I'm very pleased that it brings Dr. Melanick to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
Every time you begin to tell a story at a cocktail party, your husband reminds people that this can only end badly. Should my listeners consider themselves similarly warned?
Well, the topics that I tackle are a little bit challenging. I do talk about death, but one thing that I get across in the book is the point that we are trying to figure things out in order to help the living. That's the point of what we do.
But should people with a queasy stomach who are having lunch right now, perhaps?
It depends on the questions you have. I don't know. I don't know what you're going to ask me.
Well, what's the question you are most frequently asked, not by me, but by others?
The thing I'm most frequently asked is whether it's like CSI, so whether my job is just like it is on the television shows, and it's definitely not. One of the things I tackle in the book is the fact that I'm not walking around in high-heeled shoes. Those are dangerous if you're walking around a dead body. You don't want to trip and fall. And most of my cases are actually not homicides. I'm not solving crimes constantly. Many of the cases are sudden, unexpected deaths that occur from natural disease or from accidents.
But we've been fascinated by medical examiners for a while in the popular culture. I'm just thinking of TV. There was Quincy Medical Examiner with Jack Quickman way back when. There's Bones, there's CSI. Why do you think that is?
I always say it's the melding of the cop show and the doctor show, the what if they mated, so to speak. So I think that that's the fascination, is that now the cop is also a doctor. The doctor is also a detective. So that's why I think people are fascinated by it.
And you're saying that that was just a small part of your job. But you did have that experience.
I do detective work, but the detective work is not what you'd expect. It's not trying to track down criminals or culprits in murders. It's trying to figure out what's the person's medical history, what drugs are they on, what medications were they prescribed.
As we have seen in a recent case in Ferguson, Missouri, medical examiners don't always agree.
That is correct. So what happens is you sometimes have experts looking at the same set of data and coming to different conclusions. And sometimes it's because they aren't looking at the same set of data. For instance, in the Ferguson, Missouri case, you have the medical examiner who has access to the scene and the crime scene information, the police investigation and the clothing. And then the second autopsy pathologist did not have access to that material.
And that person was just extrapolating from the information that he'd been given?
He was working off just what's on the body and not incorporating the additional scene information because that wasn't made available to him.
As I said, you began your career expecting to be a surgeon. Isn't medical examiner close to the opposite of that work?
It's technical in the sense that we still are doing surgery, but we're doing it on a dead body. The other similarities actually have to do with the contact we have with families. So people always joke around with me that my patients don't complain, they'll still be dead tomorrow, they're not going to page me in the middle of dinner. And yet, I'm not doing this for the dead bodies, I'm doing it for their families.
But you aren't working the same hours that you had to when you were doing your residency. Was that a big problem for you?
The hours were much more grueling in surgical residency, and I honestly don't think that it's necessary to train surgeons that way. Many of those decisions are financial, but for me, I had to find the right path for myself.
And it's been pointed out that mistakes get made under that kind of pressure. You tell a story of a time when a pharmacy called you to question a prescription they'd received for a patient of yours.
And in that case, I was asked whether I wanted to put in 200 units of insulin in their Hyperal. It was actually had to do with nutritional support. And I caught someone else's mistake. And I know that the person who wrote that prescription was exhausted from being on call all night long. So mistakes do get made. And a friend recently gave me a statistics that about 30 deaths occur every day in the United States from medical errors.
Not just bad prescriptions or things where somebody wrote 200 instead of 20, something like that. But also, we're talking about people who have scalpels in their hands.
And surgery. So one of the topics I discuss in Working Stiff is therapeutic complications. In New York City, we actually have a special manner of death called therapeutic complications, where anyone who dies as a consequence of surgery may have that classification if the death was a consequence of the technique.
Well, in the case of Joan Rivers, she was famous, so people were paying attention. But I suspect an awful lot of this stuff gets unreported.
It is up to the hospitals. They're the ones who have to report the cases. But in many cases, we also have family members who call the office and say, I think that the surgeons killed my wife, or I think the surgeons killed my mother. And so the medical examiner's office will take those calls as well and investigate those deaths, even if it's not reported by the hospital.
My guest is Dr. Judy Melnick, who, with her husband T.J. Mitchell, has written Working Stiff, 2 years, 262 Bodies, and the Making of a Medical Examiner. It's published by Scribner. Were you afraid to give it up when you were faced with having to make a decision? After all, there's all that prestige, and you'd worked hard on your residency.
It was hard because in medical school, you're basically taught or told that if you give up at any point, you are going to be unemployable, that somehow if you leave your residency, nobody will want to hire you. So that was definitely a fear on my part. I had worked in the pathology department at UCLA when I was a medical student, so they were willing to take me outside the match.
Is an autopsy like a cadaver dissection that you do in med school?
It is and it isn't. For one thing, you don't have to have anesthesia. The person's not in pain. But you are doing surgery on the dead body. You're taking out the organs using scalpels and forceps and similar equipment. One advantage we have over surgery is we can do a much wider incision, so we see the anatomy a lot better. We also have to have an understanding of surgical technique, because if someone had surgery, like the Joan Rivers case where she's had a surgical technique, we need to know what the surgeons did and what the potential complications are.
Now, I remember when we had to dissect a guinea pig in college, and some people were perfectly happy to go cutting into that dead carcass, and others were very squeamish and had to leave the room or thought they were going to throw up. Does it take a certain kind of type of person, perhaps a little ghoulish, to do well in this field?
You have to have a fascination with science as the get-go. I think that it's not a question of ghoulishness. It's a question of what drives you that's positive in your life. So all of us are put off by the smells in the morgue. Everybody who goes into forensics has to deal with decomposed bodies and horrible things that we see, both the violence as well as the natural effects of aging or death. But we overcome those because we're fascinated by the science and we want to help people.
There is just the whole matter of dealing with death all the time. Do forensic pathologists have to cultivate a detachment from their subjects that goes beyond what most doctors have to practice?
I find that in forensics, it's actually easier in some way because I know that the body is an object to some degree. They're no longer suffering. Their soul is gone. And
I haven't had a talk with them before.
Well, I have sometimes spoken to their families, so I know that it's significant, and what I'm doing is for them. It's not for the dead body. It's for the survivors. They're the ones that matter.
In a way, you're speaking on their behalf, aren't you?
It's important for them because that's their medical history. So anything I find out from the autopsy, whether it's a criminal act that then will get prosecuted or if it's just a natural disease, it has relevance to the family because that becomes their medical history. They can go to their doctor and learn about their own health behavior.
Has your work made you more cautious or fearful of the things in your own life or your children's?
Just the opposite, actually. It's freed me from what I call the 6 o'clock news phobias that most people have because I know what actually kills people. So, for instance, look both ways before you cross the street. I know we're here in New York, but please don't jaywalk. That yellow line on the subway, it's there for a reason.
So it's just simply all of this is a cautionary tale as far as you're concerned.
Every single one is a lesson, and I learn from it not only about what actually does kill people to keep myself and my family safe, but it also makes me appreciate life every single day.
Let's take a little break, and we'll talk about your actual experiences. My guest is Judy Melnick. She has written with T.J. Mitchell, Working Stiff, 2 years, 262 Bodies, and The Making of a Medical Examiner. It's published by Scribner. Stay with us for more. And we are back with Dr. Judy Melinick, M-E-L-I-N-E-K, who, with her husband T.J. Mitchell, has written Working Stiff, 2 Years, 262 Bodies, and the Making of a Medical Examiner. It's published by Scribner. What was your role in writing this book, and what was your husband's role?
I kept a journal. So when I was doing my forensics fellowship training, I took notes every day. I was actually on the Spuyten Duyvil train coming out from Riverdale and also on the Liberty Lines bus taking notes with two fingers, and then on a little Hewlett-Packard 200LX. So it was downloaded every night. And then at the end of my fellowship training, I took the stories, which were in chronological order, because one day I'd do the autopsy, and then maybe 2 weeks later I'd get a report from the police, and then a month later I'd get the toxicology report, and maybe a year later I'd testify in court. So I had to take them out of chronological order in order to create the individual stories. And then I picked the ones with TJ that would have the most important lessons that I learned, whether those lessons were forensic lessons or emotional lessons.
Now, obviously, you have to take those notes because if it's going to cover such a long span of time, when you testify, you might not remember all the details.
That's correct. So I usually, when I'm testifying, I rely on the reports that I write for the autopsy. But for writing this book, there was both a journal, which I documented my emotional growth, and also my academic notes, the things I learned. But really, I say to people that it's my story, but it's TJ's book, because he's the writer.
After you decided not to become a surgeon, you did an internship in pathology at UCLA. How did you come to do your rotation in forensic pathology in the New York City office of the chief medical examiner? Why not stay in L.A.?
I'm originally from New York, so I grew up here, and my chief resident at the time at UCLA said, well, in Los Angeles, all you get to see are car accidents and decomposed bodies. If you go to New York, you'll really learn stuff. So I took his advice.
There are no gangbangers in L.A.?
Well, there are, but the way the training program occurred there is the residents were given the easy cases. Mm-hmm. And in New York, there's a teaching program, and Dr. Charles Hirsch, who was the chief medical examiner until he retired last year, advocated for teaching, and he's part of the NYU Medical Center program. So we had medical students and residents constantly rotating. So the emphasis on training and education was what really inspired me, and that's why I came here.
Part of your job is dealing with the death certificate?
So we write the death certificate, but we can't write it until we do the autopsy. Remember, the cases that come to the medical examiner's office are not cases where people know why they died. They're sudden, unnatural, or violent deaths. So when someone dies in the hospital of cancer, that doesn't get reported to the ME's office.
Or if you die in your bed just because you were of old age or something like that.
If you die in your bed of old age, but your doctor hasn't seen you within 20 days, you're going to the medical examiner's office. So there are actually rules written in the law about what cases are going to get autopsied. And we will triage those cases when they come into the office based on the importance or the forensic significance. So if somebody has heart disease and their doctor is willing to sign the death certificate, we wouldn't necessarily autopsy that one, but it'll still get investigated.
Can a family request an autopsy?
In New York City, they honor requests. Not all jurisdictions do. The requests depend on what the circumstances are. So if the case is suspicious in some way, they tend to be honored a lot more than just, we want to know for curiosity's sake. Those cases tend to be done in hospitals or by medically trained pathologists, not forensic pathologists.
So when a job came to you, it was because there was some question, perhaps a potential legal action, possible civil or criminal?
That is exactly right. So there are cases that are suspicious in some way or where the doctors themselves couldn't figure out the cause of death. Those are the most challenging cases.
Why is the autopsy suite called the Pit?
I don't know who named it that. That's what Dr. Flomenbaum, the deputy chief, told me it was called when I came in. And it wasn't a pit. It was actually a very neat and clean place. It was just passed down the generations. The office has since relocated, so they're now in a new building. And I don't know if they still call it that or not.
What kind of equipment is in it? Would this be the same as just a regular operating room?
Not exactly. So we use saws that are a little bigger, and our protective gear is a little bit more extreme because we don't want to cut ourselves. So we'll have layers of gloves with some cloth gloves in between. It's less important for us to be able to have fine motor skills the way a vascular surgeon would need, and more important for us to be able to lop the ribs off, which we do with garden shears. We don't do those with surgical equipment.
In fact, you said that a lot of the equipment is the kind of thing you could buy at the local houseware store.
In fact, where I worked in San Francisco, there was a local restaurant store where they would sell restaurant equipment, and they would also sharpen knives. And because I came in there so often, they gave me the 10% discount because they said I was, quote-unquote, in the business.
Now, you mentioned Dr. Charles Hirsch, who just retired. How long was he at the medical examiner's office?
I believe he was there for over 30 years, so he just recently retired last year.
And you say he had some peculiarities of language?
He had expressions that we called Hirschisms, and they were the teaching points, the expressions that he would have. For instance, one of them would be, don't confuse the autopsy with the death investigation, because it's only one part of the investigation that we do to figure out the death.
How did he respond when someone presented the body of a man and said it had been shot by a lady?
He said, ladies don't shoot people. So he was very careful. We'd have to define people as man or woman, not lady or gentleman. He wanted us to use very specific language because it was important that we be accurate on the death certificate and accurate in our communications with people.
How long does it take to do a typical autopsy?
A typical autopsy, as Dr. Hirsch would say, skin to skin, takes about 45 minutes. So that would be from the time I examine the outside of the body, take out the organs, examine the organs, and then they get put back. But that's not the full autopsy. You have to wait until toxicology reports come back. Those could take a month. And then sometimes you can get police reports and additional investigation.
Were there certain things that you always looked for?
We do have a checklist. So I do have a body diagram where I will draw out on the diagram any injuries to the body or any findings that I have. And then I also have a checklist for all the organs to make sure I don't miss anything.
Didn't you once misread a tattoo?
I did. So if you have a tattoo on the bodies, and sometimes they fade with age, if I called it something and the family member knew it was something else, it would cause problems because they would challenge me and they would think that I didn't autopsy the right person. Mm-hmm. So you have to be very careful with interpreting things like tattoos.
And we're seeing more and more tattoos these days. I guess medical examiners are going to be busier and busier trying to figure out whether that's a scar or a tattoo.
In some cases, I will actually
try to
say,
read what the Chinese actually means.
What I will do when it's not clear is I'll say documented photographically, and that way I can get away with not having to describe every single one.
What's meant by the medical school maxim, when you hear hoofbeats, think of horses, not zebras?
So in medical school, you're taught anytime you have a condition or a symptom to come up with a list of diseases that it could possibly be, and that's called the differential diagnosis. And the medical students typically will come up with the most obscure or weird ones first because they don't have a sense of priority. So in medical school, you're taught when you hear hoofbeats, think of horses, not zebra. Think of the most common things, not the unusual things.
Although sometimes it winds up being the unusual thing, and we can miss what's wrong because of that.
So that's part of my job as a medical examiner is I need to know not only the common things, but I have to know the zebras because they are the ones that get overlooked and are unexpected, and those are the cases that come to our office.
What percentage of the cases that you saw died of some kind of trauma?
I would estimate that trauma is about 40-50% of what
that
we
much.
See. But remember, they're not all homicides. So the trauma would be things like motor vehicle accidents, falls down the stairs, things like that. The homicides are only about 10% of a typical forensic practice.
One of your first cases was a 36-year-old who'd stepped out between two cars and been hit.
So the case in question, the issue is which car hit her and what were the injuries to her body. Is that that's the one that was pregnant as well?
Mm-hmm.
So that one was hard for me because I saw the fetus as well. So it wasn't just the death of the mom, but the death of her child.
And in some states, that would mean a double homicide.
In that case, there was the issue of whether it was a hit and run, so which car hit her, because you had two conflicting stories, and so the injuries on the body could help us identify which was the car that did the primary injury.
But do you have to speak to the drivers to find out what they say happened?
That's the police's job. So the police
did
will
they provide you with that information?
Yes. Yeah, so this is where we collaborate with the police. So the police will give us information, and then we look on the body, and we tell them whether it's consistent or not consistent with the information they're being given, that they are being given or that they are giving us. In some cases, when it didn't match up, I would ask the police to do additional investigation, and sometimes they wanted to, and sometimes they didn't. So there's relationship of collaboration, but also a certain degree of mutual suspicion between coroners and medical examiners with the police.
Well, sometimes you're telling them to do more work than they may want to do. They have a lot on their plates at any given moment.
That's true. And you have to understand also that their job is to investigate homicides and try to catch the perpetrators. So if they know who it is, if it's a pretty straightforward, like we have a suspect, they're more than happy to pursue it. But when they have no clue about who could have done it, my telling them it's a homicide doesn't make their life any easier.
What criteria are there for determining whether something's a homicide?
What criteria have to do with examining the body as well as examining the scene? So if I have a body that has a lot of trauma, but they are dumped in a field and there's nothing that could have caused that trauma, it's pretty straightforward that they were probably hit and then dumped there, as opposed to that if they're in the street, they may have been hit by a car. So you have to take it in the context of the scene.
How many alcohol and drug-related deaths are there in a city like New York?
We saw a lot of alcohol and drug-related deaths, and there's two types of alcohol and drug-related deaths. There's the acute intoxication, where a person overdoses, and that's a poisoning or an accident. And then the more common, actually, are the chronic effects of alcohol and drug abuse, where people have been drinking for many years and have managed to damage their liver sufficiently. So when they die, they may not have any alcohol in their system. They've stopped drinking 20 years ago, but their liver's damaged to the point of no return.
Would you say that alcohol is the most damaging?
I would say I see much more death from alcohol than I see from other drugs combined.
Heroin overdoses come and go. There was one case where somebody started fire smoking crack. So there can be all sorts of drug-related problems.
And that case was one where I had to cooperate with the police and work with them because he went out the window and had stab wounds on his arms that I thought were caused by another person. And they're the ones who went back to the scene and got photographs of the glass window that he went out of. And I could see that the shards were sharp enough to cause stab wounds.
Is it difficult to tell whether there's been foul play in the death of a drug addict or an alcoholic?
It's hard sometimes because you don't often get a full history. The person may have gotten dumped at the emergency room or picked up off the street, and I may not have any kind of investigation, especially if they died a week later or a month later. Those are difficult cases in some circumstances.
There was the case of Mary Lynch, who was a wealthy Upper East Side matron who was an alcoholic.
She was found at the bottom of the stairs, and the initial information suggested that she was just a tumble or a fall down the stairs, and she did appear intoxicated based on the smell of alcohol. But this is a really good example of a case where getting phone calls from, in her case, her best friends called me and told me, this is suspicious because she should not have been found by her husband. Her husband was estranged, and he didn't have a key to her apartment building, so something is going on here. And by getting phone calls from family members after the autopsy is done, it can prompt additional investigation.
But there's no way for you with an autopsy to know whether somebody pushed her down the stairs or whether she tripped and fell.
Well, in that particular case, the learning point was that I went and examined her body the day after the autopsy, and the blood had drained during the autopsy, so bruises that weren't visible on the first day were now visible on the second day.
My guest is Judy Melnick, who with her husband T.J. Mitchell has written Working Stiff, 2 years, 262 bodies in the making of a medical examiner. In looking over your history, it's kind of surprising you went into medicine. Your father was a doctor, but he committed suicide.
He was a psychiatrist, and I think that in some ways, looking back now and in writing the book, I realized that a large portion of the reason why I'm drawn to forensics is because I suffered through that loss when I was 13 years old. So especially a traumatic death like a suicide, that's not expected. To be able to help families find closure and understand the death, especially when it doesn't make any sense, and suicides frequently do not make sense, to let them understand that that's okay and why it's a suicide, that gives me closure and helps other people as well.
And you had to deal with a number of suicides in your work. Is that one of the reasons that you were so open about what happened with your father?
I'm open about it.
Because a lot of people do keep those things secret.
I'm a great believer in communication and talking, and I think that when we look back, for example, on the AIDS or HIV movement in the 70s, when they started to have those posters that said silence equals death, there was a realization that by not talking about HIV and AIDS, we were perpetuating this epidemic. And I think the same thing applies for other unmentionables like suicide. Families will say, well, he died of a heart attack, which is what they told other people in my family about my dad, when really we need to confront the mechanism, suicide, head on in order to be able to prevent these deaths.
You say that in New York City, suicides frequently happen in the same places.
There were some common locations, and what we've also learned from the medical literature is by changing things, like by putting up barriers to suicide in one hotel where people
were... The Marriott Marquis
at the time,
Hotel in Times Square? Why was that a popular suicide place?
It had a low banister and a very high inner atrium, so people would go up there. But it's been changed since then. They put up barriers, and you cannot commit suicide in there anymore. By putting up barriers to suicide, we can actually decrease the overall suicide rate. The people will not then find another alternative. The actual rate goes down.
That's why it's hard to jump off of a bridge these days.
There's a reason for that. We're trying to prevent deaths, and this is where medical examiners and coroners, by doing death investigations and speaking openly about what we find, can actually influence public policy and protect the public health.
Do families ever balk when you determine that the cause of a death was a suicide or a drug overdose?
It depends on their background. In some cases, they're upset about suicides because they feel that it indicates mental illness and it's a shame on the family. In some religious environments, suicides are you're going to go to hell. In other circumstances, when it's an overdose, there was one case where a mother kept calling me because she didn't accept the fact that her son's death was an overdose from him trying to get high, and she wanted to blame his drug dealer.
Do you have to have a bedside manner with the families?
Definitely cultivated over time. That's something I learned on the job and I document in the book.
Were you working in the medical examiner's office on September 11, 2001?
I started my training in July 2001. So I had 2 months. I had July and August before September 11th happened. So that was my training ground. I didn't want the book to be entirely about September 11th. It's not. It's about forensic training. And it was important for me to tackle that part of my training. But I do it at the end of the book for several reasons, because anybody who reads it has to be able to understand the basics of natural death, traumatic deaths, and what we do on routine cases before they can wrap their head around all of the complexities of what I had to learn on the job with regards to identification.
Including identifying body parts a year after the destruction of the towers.
So it was a long process, and in the immediate effects, we had bodies that we could identify based on physical features such as their hair color, eye color, or even jewelry inscriptions. But as time wore on and we were dealing with the fires and we're dealing with decomposition, it became harder and harder to identify, and we relied more on DNA.
We don't have much time left, but do you think that the couple of years that you spent at the New York Medical Examiner's Office were particularly busy ones? Because we mentioned September 11th, there was also the anthrax scare. There was the crash of American Airlines Flight 587 that November.
Those were unusual years, and I just wrote a journal to try to document what I was going through. I had no expectation that anything like that could ever have happened. I'm glad I kept the journal. It helped keep me sane during that time, but I think it was also important for my colleagues as they read about it when we go back now.
Judy Melnick and T.J. Mitchell wrote Working Stiff, 2 Years, 262 Bodies, and the Making of a Medical Examiner. It is published by Scribner. Thank you so much for being on our show.
I really appreciate you inviting me.